I think that just as we're living in a nuclear age, we have grown so tremendously in scientific knowledge. It doesn't seem too much to say that men can begin to awaken to the fact that they haven't grown enough spiritually and haven't recognized their spiritual capacities.
Once something like eating is death, then you've struck at the very heart of life. The enemy of the older radical theories may have been the ruling class, but today the stakes of whether we will reform ourselves into a new kind of human being, a new kind of society, whether we will find selves worth being, the stakes of it are simply life itself.
All right, I've got a special program for today. It's Christmas Eve, and I thought it would be a good time to introduce you guys to my dad, who's 96 years old, and he is somebody who still does a lot and is very active. And today, though, we're going to talk about some of his memories from growing up and how things were different where he came from. So I'm going to turn it over to him and just start asking him some questions. I thought maybe it would be good to just start out letting people know where you came from, where you grew up, and what it was, a little bit of what it was like.
Okay. Well, yeah, I actually I was born in Winchester, Kentucky. It's a town in central Kentucky, about 15 miles east of Lexington. And I was born in 1927. And by the time I was old enough to really know much about what was going on, we were into the Depression, the Great Depression. That had a big effect on my life because, there are just so many things that we didn't have access to. One of them was when I was old enough to go to school, and we would have recess in the middle of the morning, and at recess, if you could pay for it, you would get a small bottle of milk and a graham cracker and a napkin and a straw. And I look forward to that because, you know, food at home was pretty scarce. But even then, I mean, if you didn't have the 3 cents, you didn't get the breakfast treat unless somebody was sick and you got theirs. And I was usually hoping somebody would be sick. Yeah. Anyway, but those days, one thing that was good about those days was that family tended to really stick together, at least I know in our family we did. We tried to, each of us tried to help the other. And a lot of that. And I know I had in my young days, in my school days, grade school, I did have a lot of freedom to go anywhere in town I wanted, you know, without anybody being concerned about whether I'd get back home safely. At times, I would even stop by the county jail in warm weather, and the jailbirds would be looking out the window, and I'd have conversations with them. At one time during the Depression, I went over to the railroad tracks, and there was a spring there where they could get good drinking water and cook. And the stuff that they would take out of people's gardens and stuff, they would cook that over an open fire in tin cans. And they even offered me some of their food, but I was a little bit afraid to take it. But anyway, I did grow up with a great deal of freedom, and I think that has stood me well, all my life, being able to, you know, to relate to people on a one-to-one basis, no matter who they are or where they are. Okay.
Yeah. Would maybe characterize like what about what size town was Winchester, and did
Yeah.
you live in a sort of rural or in a more of an urban setting?
Well, actually, Winchester at that time was, I think, about 5,000 population, I believe. Now it probably is around 20. I'm not sure, but I think it's around 20, 30,000. It is, I'd say it's probably kind of a commute town to Lexington.
Yeah, that it is.
That's right, yeah. Of course, interstate goes east-west through there between Lexington and Winchester, so it'd just be a few minutes drive to get in there. And I did spend it. There were times when we lived in the country during when I was growing up. We lived, in fact, during the Depression, one of the things my father had to do was he was a hired hand on a farm at. And the farms in Kentucky in those days, the money crop was tobacco, but he was, I think he was getting 50 cents a day, and there was a little house that about the size of not quite as big as some people's garages, but we managed to it'd be it was mom and dad and my sister and me, and then my brother was born actually at that time, so I would have been probably at that time I'd been about 5 years old.
So, did you guys, so would you describe your family as mainly living on farms or mainly living in town? And like, what was the difference between, I say, like people who lived and worked on farms as opposed to in town?
Well, I know we lived when I was growing up. The only time that we lived on a farm was during the Depression. Actually, my father took me out of school when I turned 16 to work. But at that time, we lived in town, but I was still. Well, actually, we were getting ready. At that time, we were getting ready to move to the farm. It was during the war. She'd been about 43, I believe. One of the big differences on a farm, at least in Kentucky, if you had some ingenuity, and if you were physically capable. You didn't need to go hungry. I mean, you would grow your food. You had your chickens, you had your milk cow, or you could make your butter and cottage cheese, and then you'd have your buttermilk, then you had eggs, all the eggs you wanted. You could raise your own hogs, have a big garden. If you're on the farm and you really wanted to work, I mean, you could grow your food. In fact, even on our utilities, there were no utility bills because you cut firewood for your heat and for your cooking. You didn't have a water bill because you pull that out of a well or a cistern. You didn't have electricity because you had kerosene lamps, and so, those are some things that nowadays every person has to function. They pretty much have to have those things. But I know during that period of time, we just didn't have any income. We were waiting for income when we sold the tobacco crop, and my dad was a sharecropper, and he got half of it. But until that tobacco crop was sold, you did without money pretty much,
But you could do without it if you had access to land because you weren't really
Right.
most of those things you didn't need money to keep going.
That's right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's interesting. I know you've told me about the difference between farm kids and town kids at lunchtime during the
Yeah, there's one time I remember we lived at the edge of town. It was just over the county line, so I had to go to a little country school. And when we would get out our lunches, I remember one time it was in the fall of the year. We had a few green tomatoes left we'd grown in our garden, and I remember I would get out my biscuit and green tomato sandwich. And I see these country kids pull out a fried chicken leg, and that pretty much summed it up. That was the difference between living in town and being a country kid.
Right. And of course, Kentucky was, you could, the financial situation was bad during the Depression, but the environment in Kentucky was a lot better than in, say, Kansas or
Right.
Nebraska, where the Dust Bowl had kind of hit. But in a
Yeah.
lot of parts of the country, the Dust Bowl wasn't a thing, other than you
Right.
caught the dust, right?
Oh, we would get some of that dust blowing in, but it didn't wreck agriculture like it did out in the western states.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so like I remember you telling me about what you might call foraging, that you did quite a bit of that as a kid.
Oh
You want to
yeah.
tell people about
Oh
that?
yeah. Blackberries, for example, just grew wild all over the place. And railroads, there's two railroad lines ran through Winchester, and I used them for my mode of transportation to get to the country, because I could, from my house, a short walk over to the railroad track, and I could walk down a railroad track about a mile or two and just get over to some farmer's field and start picking blackberries. Where I'd find an apple tree or a plum tree or anything like that, I'd help myself to it. If something was growing wild and it was edible and I wanted it, I got
And
it.
that was just a common practice, like
Common practice.
no problem. It wasn't like
Oh no,
anybody
nobody,
would.
no, nobody ever. In fact, I seldom ever saw any other human being when I was out on those runs. But if they had seen me, they'd been fine. I mean, there's no problem with it.
But asparagus is something you told me about that grew up.
Sometime, you run across when you're going through the countryside, there'd be a old farmhouse that has been abandoned for quite a long time. And they would have had gardens and fruit trees and stuff, and that's where you really could. And they would have asparagus, of course, that had survived.
Right,
Yeah.
yeah. People's asparagus, rhubarb, and things like that that they planted a long time
Yeah,
ago and still
right.
there.
One of the things that I really loved in the fall of the year were pawpaws. In the fall of the year, those pawpaw trees were really abundant down there. And when those pawpaws in the fall after first frost, the skin starts to turning a little black, and then they're really good. They're really ripe and ready to eat.
Yeah, I've heard about pawpaws. They're making a comeback, and people are planting them as far west as or far north as Kansas now,
Yeah.
and they're working. So like you also did a little bit of like hunting with your dad, right?
Oh, I did a lot. My dad was a turtle hunter. And he, there were numerous creeks in central Kentucky, and those creeks were just teeming with life. I mean, I would go with him as a kid. I'd go with him turtle hunting, and I'd take a one of those 100-pound burlap bags along, and the turtle, when you catch turtles, they'd be too heavy for me to carry. But I'd get in a creek with him with that bag and would catch a turtle, put it in the bag, and I'd float it. That was easy transportation for, what do you call it? But he would actually, those turtles would go back up into the bank of the creek, and that's where they'd lay in there. And he actually hunted them with his bare hands, and once he touched turtle shell, or then he'd either He'd either get a turtle by the tail or by the behind the head, by the neck, and he would pull him out of there, pull the turtle out, you know. And there have been times when he would get latch on to a turtle is so big and heavy, it was hard for him to get out. And I would actually reach in there and help him. I would get a kid heavy, but he may have it by the tail, and I would get in reach and get him by the hind leg or whatever.
Now that's
But
kind of dangerous, isn't it?
well, there was, if you know your work on the hind end of the turtle, you know, go and get snapped.
Okay, because they're snapping turtles, they have big jaws,
Oh yeah.
right?
You one of the big dangers there when you're carrying them in a burlap bag, and if you can't hold that bag away from your legs, yeah, they snap through that bag to get you. Yeah.
Oh. So, you know, you've mentioned the creeks and, you know, just the abundance of things in the water. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about more about what that was like back then, sort of the abundance of nature and the water and things like that. And then, you know, kind of your observations over time as to changes that have taken place in the environment.
Yeah. All right. At that time, the streams were just loaded with minnows, with crawdads, with all kinds of life. You could see it right in the streams. And when you walk along the creek banks, you'd be stepping on mint and just the smell of it. I mean, it smelled like it was really living. And yeah, it's but you know, over time, with the farming, with the chemicals especially, I know in those days we used very few chemicals in our crops, but you know, we keep pouring those chemicals into the streams, and I was in this creek is I think called Little Stoner Creek. You know, as a kid, I had done turtle hunting with my father in Little Stoner when it was just teeming with life. And I was standing on a bridge. This would have been about probably 40 years ago. I was standing on a bridge just looking down at the stream. There's no life in it. You couldn't see anything moving, you know. But one thing my father would do, you know, on those streams in Kentucky, between farms, they were for a fence that had to go across a creek. They built what they call a water gap. And this water gap would have cables, and then it would have boards on it, like built kind of a fence in the water. But I've seen snakes sunning out there on those water gaps, just all over the place. And furthermore, I've seen my father go in there and run the snakes out and go in a hunt for turtles. At first, I know he only got bit. I was with him when he got bit once. And what happened was he reached in under after the turtle and he raised his hand above the water level, and there was a snake laying back in there that was above the water level, and it bit him on a hand.
Oh.
And my.
Okay.
My father was he chewed tobacco. So he just when he got that snake bite, he put that big wad of that tobacco on the snake bite and wrapped it with a handkerchief, and we just kept rattling. I
Okay.
don't think the tobacco did anything, but he thought it
You never know. Maybe you
did.
got caught that from somebody, or maybe the snake just wasn't poisonous or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Wow. I know that you know, Wendell Berry kind of got going on ecology after you know, and he comes from the same general area in Kentucky.
Yeah.
After like seeing the strip mining pollution and you know the damage
Yeah.
from all that to the streams in particular, you
Right.
know, and it struck him as just ugly and you know destructive. So I've always been struck by like what you've had to say about the difference. And even within my own lifetime, I've seen a big difference in what I can see in the water. And that's dismaying. Like Wendell Berry ties it up with with God to a certain extent, and our, sort of like our relationship with the earth, what's required of us in that regard. Do you ever think of it that way?
Well, yeah, I know that God is the God, at least this is my belief, that God is the creator of everything. And nature is intended, everything builds onto something else. It's in harmony, it's supposed to be in harmony. And when you wipe out any part of that trend, to me, and the way I think, you wipe out any one part of that, you upset what God is intending to be done. I mean, it's
Well, and listening to you, it occurred to me that, one gauge for trying to figure out how well your human relationship is with the environment is just whether the environment around you is beautiful.
Oh yeah, well, I tend to try to look for the beauty as much as I can. I know my wife, when she was out at a park, she had said many times that this is what heaven is. She considered nature as like almost like heaven, you know. And I think that for all of us, life could be a lot more, I'd say, happy if we when we take on a positive view of things. I mean, if all you're doing is just seeing what you can't do, you're probably not going to do much.
Yeah, true enough. True enough. Well, was there anything else you wanted to talk about or like any other thoughts, advice?
No, well, the main thing is to actually try to put trust and belief in other people until they really show you that you can't do it, you know? I mean, don't enter into any kind of a relationship with other people on the downside. I mean, if they prove to you that, well, maybe you better be somewhere else, well, then that's you better be somewhere else.
I see. So basically you're saying like go into relationships with the idea that you're dealing with trustworthy people,
Right.
or else what? Or else you're going to maybe end up.
I don't think I've ever really quickly changed anybody's behavior habits. That tends to take time,
And so then if they prove untrustworthy, then that's the time to maybe change how you deal with them.
Except that you don't want to hold a grudge against them. You don't want to take the attitude that they can't change, but just don't waste your time trying to do a quick fix.
Don't try to do a quick fix. I love that. It's generally a good idea to not try to fix people. People have to kind of learn
Yes.
on their own, don't they?
I've had, as a teacher, as a high school teacher, I've had students that it might take me months to build the kind of relationship I would like to have, but it happens over time, but it doesn't happen immediately.
Well, I mean, on this subject, thinking back to like how things were when you were younger, was that the way that was that sort of trusting approach? Or trust first, anyway, approach, was that pretty typical of people
I
back
don't
then?
think any, no, I don't
No?
really.
Okay,
I
why
don't.
not?
I mean, I one of the things that bothered me about the environment that I grew up in, there was an awful lot of people that work on a statistic of one. If it happens once, it'll happen forever, and so and that's hard. If you take that attitude about people, if that's what they did once, they're going to do it forever, then you're on the wrong track.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And I know I'll have you back at some point to talk more about relationships because you're really good at that. But you've just kind of revealed one of your keys there, I think, is go into relationships expecting the best and then being somewhat forgiving.
But don't think that you're just going to give them the word and all of a sudden they're going to change.
As though they just don't see reason and you can make them see it. Right. Well, you've always seemed to have quite a bit of forbearance, for people,
Well,
which is a good
I try
quality.
to,
Yeah. Well, thanks, and I hope you enjoyed this little discussion with my dad. Like I said, we'll probably do another one sometime, next year, which is right around the corner. More on relationships because he's very good at that, as you can just see. He thinks quite a bit about that. So, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. I'll see you in 2024.